This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe John Huth. He's a professor of physics at Harvard University. He's author of the book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. And he'll be giving a talk tonight titled Navigation and the Lost Art of Wayfinding. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium at 6:30, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. Very interesting book about a side of information technology that we probably don't think about all that often, and that is the more our devices do for us, the more skills we can let go of, and then we stop having those skills. I know that I don't remember anybody's phone number anymore, for example, and where navigation is concerned, a lot of skills that maybe a lot more people used to have are kind of going by the wayside. What are some of those?
Well, some of them are just developing a map of your surroundings in your mind. Parts of our brain are wired to acquire what psychologists call a cognitive map, which is, in a sense, if you're looking down on your environment from far above, you have an idea of where everything is. And if you want to get from point A to point B, you might take shortcuts without even necessarily knowing exactly the path that you need to take. And with modern GPSs, which are telling you turn left, turn right, you have a much more constricted view of your environment, if you have a view at all. In a sense, you might say you're almost blindfolded to that. So you're cutting out a whole part of your cognitive apparatus by relinquishing control to GPSs.
It's funny because, I mean, you can go on Google Maps or whatever kind of map program and have that overview map, but you can't have it when you're trying to actually get there.
Right.
And I find myself kind of missing the old-fashioned paper maps.
Yeah, me too. What I often do, I never carry a GPS with me, even though it might prove to be at my peril. But what I try to do whenever I'm entering a new territory is to start to get a big picture of what the major routes are, and then how would I get from one place to the other, and then pay attention. So just coming over here, I was paying attention to the road signs and what were the major arteries and which way is the courthouse and the Capitol, that kind of thing.
Did you actually see a map of Santa Fe?
Yeah, I was looking this morning. I was looking at a map of Santa Fe and trying to get an idea for the major routes and the major landmarks. So as I traveled around, I could start to orient myself.
There are all kinds of examples of technology that have unexpected outcomes. And you were saying, you know, maybe at my peril, I leave my GPS at home. But for example, when anti-lock brakes were invented, everybody thought there'd be fewer accidents, but there were more accidents because people drove more recklessly because they thought they could count on their anti-lock
right.
brakes. And there's a lot of things like that. And I wondered, are fewer people getting lost because of GPS? Are they taking more risks because they have GPS?
Yeah, that's one. And another one is these personal locator beacons that people take with them, the sense being that if you get into trouble, you push a button and then your coordinates get relayed to some place where search and rescue teams will be alerted, and then you have the sense that they can come and find you. But that's rarely the case. We had a recent instance last year in the White Mountains where a woman was trying to do a traverse of the Presidential Range, didn't listen to the weather forecast, got caught in a blizzard, punched her GPS, but the conditions were so severe that the search and rescue teams just couldn't come and get her. And so there's this kind of false sense of security that encourages the people.
Yeah, and she lost her life.
She did.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people to this day losing their lives. I mean, you told a story. You are a kayaker, and you were caught in a sudden thick fog bank, and you used some navigational tools, which maybe you can tell us about, to find your way back. And a very similar thing happened, and two young women lost their lives because they didn't have some of those simple tools.
Yeah. So, I guess about 3 months before that incident, I got caught in a thick fog, didn't have a compass or a GPS, and I had to think very quickly.
And you were on the ocean.
I was on the ocean. I was off the coast of Maine. And basically, if I paddled in the wrong direction, I would have just paddled out to sea. And I noticed the wind direction. I noticed the direction the swells were running. And I could hear the sound of waves crashing on a very rocky beach. And I had a kind of mental map of the islands around me. And I was able to use these as directional indicators to find my way through the landscape. So in the day of this incident, I was off of Cape Cod, perfectly sunny day, which often happens when you get fog rolling in. And I pushed off and I noted the wind direction and kind of the way the waves were getting pushed by it, started paddling. And I didn't know this, but at exactly the same time I've shoved off, there were two young women who were about a half a mile down the beach also starting out to paddle. And I went paddling, and about half an hour later, a very, very thick fog rolled in. I mean, you could barely see the end of the kayak. And so I used the wind direction to as a way of orienting myself and found my way to the coastline, which ran east-west. And then I just found my way along the coastline. And any time the houses or parts of the coast would fall out of view because of the fog, I just knew to turn north to be able to get to the coastline, and made my way back. And I honestly didn't think much about it because it just seemed all natural and intuitive to me. And it wasn't until the next day that I found out that these two young women got lost in the fog and there was a massive search and rescue mission going on. And I guess they found the body of one of the young women the day after, and never found the body of the other young woman.
And they had told their friends that they were going out for a 10-minute paddle.
Right.
And 45 minutes later, the authorities were alerted and they weren't found and they lost their lives. And it really makes you remember, because, I mean, so many of us, especially in cities, live our lives feeling relatively safe, certainly from natural forces like fog. But you can go from perfectly normal, safe to death in so quickly.
Yes, that's definitely true. Out on the ocean, in the mountains, in terrain that tends to lack features. I knew somebody who was in Colorado hunting with his brothers and just got disoriented, and because it was relatively featureless, got completely lost. So it can happen very rapidly if you don't think about your surroundings, and people get lulled into a false sense of security because they get accustomed to their environment, and all of a sudden you just change their environment or tweak things and things can become very different.
Let's talk a little bit about getting lost, because that's something that you write about in your book. That's something that happens quite a lot around here. There are always search and rescue stories in the newspaper here in Santa Fe and in New Mexico. And when a person or even a group of people or a pair of people get lost in the woods, there's a number of strategies that people try to use to find their way home. And some of them are a lot less successful and more successful than others.
Yeah. So that's been studied a fair amount. There's actually a fairly large database that now exists of where people are found as a result of search and rescue missions. And it helps effectively deploy the search and rescue teams to go out and find them, because you know, depending on the person and what they're doing and the terrain, where to concentrate your efforts. So one of the strategies is called direction traveling. So you try to find a direction and just move in that direction based on the idea that you'll find something like a road or a creek or something like that.
And do you need either a compass or some other, like the North Star or whatever, for that?
Right. You need something to maintain that direction. And if you lose that, people end up walking in loopy paths and will circle back on their paths, which happens quite frequently. Like if you're in a flat, featureless terrain and you don't maintain direction, if it's overcast, for example, and they'll be very surprised when they go circle back on the path that they were on. Another strategy that works rather well is route traveling. So you find something, even if it's just a game trail. Oftentimes animals will try to find sources of water, so you follow the game trail, and that can help. And then sometimes the adage of following creeks downstream will work, but sometimes not. You have to have some knowledge of the watershed and where the drainage is going, and people can get fooled doing that. Another strategy is if you can, to get to a high point and then survey the landscape, then you develop a mental map of your surroundings and then you start moving in that direction.
One thing that happens to people who get lost is sometimes they really panic. Mm-hmm. It seems, I mean, human beings have been on this planet for a really long time, and it seems like getting lost would be something that we have adaptive mechanisms to deal with, and panic seems so non-adaptive.
Yeah, that's one of the curious features, and it seems to be universal among humans. The only way I can explain it is that, I mean, this is just my conjecture, that we have this cognitive map in our brain of our surroundings, and then what we do is we have this route we want to take, and so then we then consciously create a set of landmarks that we check off as we are following our path from one place to another. And then typically what will happen is if you start to get lost, you bend the map. So you think a feature that you're seeing, maybe a creek, say the creek is running to the east, but in your mind you think it should be running to the north, and you convince yourself it's running in the wrong direction. And then all of a sudden your expectations of what you're seeing and in the cognitive map and what you really see don't line up. And that's where you have this breakdown between this feedback of your motion in the environment and your expectations, and all of a sudden they don't match, and that leads to panic.
It's also kind of a metaphor for how we go through our lives. I mean, a lot of us want our lives to fit our narratives, and we kind of ignore things that don't fit that narrative. And if we were really rational, or if we were to cultivate our rationality more, we might, I don't even know if we'd be better off, but we might be better truth tellers. And it's life and death when you're in the woods, but it's also relevant in daily life.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the strategies people have to get unlost, for example, route traveling or direction traveling, you might identify certain personality characteristics. So you might know somebody who is so fixated on a goal that they just keep traveling in a very straight line, oblivious to all the other things that are going on around them. Other people tend to sample routes when they're lost, but we also know personalities that try different avocations in their lives. And some people just like to survey the surroundings from a high point, and some people seem to travel somewhat randomly. And so it's not only perhaps metaphorical, but it seems that there's this emergent view that the same part of our mind that is wired to navigate also seems to be used for what's called episodic memories and planning for the future. So that same part of the brain that plans for the future is used in planning routes in actual navigation. So it may be that it's even more than just metaphorical, that it's actually part of the way our brain operates.
One of the things that you said a moment ago is there are some people who get so fixated on the route that they don't notice what's happening around them. And in your book, you write that some people get so fixated on the idea, I am going due east, that in their path due east, they'll get to a road.
Yes.
They won't see it.
Right.
And they'll cross it and continue to be lost.
Right. There's the famous story of a hunter in the Maine woods who did exactly that. And they were so fixated that their salvation would have been to just sit on the road and put out their thumb and wait for a ride. But they just walked right across it. And it's interesting. A lot of times people become quite oblivious because they become very fixated on one thing, that there are other signs that they ignore that are going on around them. And I've had this actually happen to me on a backpacking trip where my brother-in-law was very fixated on the speed that we travel. He was, in his mind, we had to be traveling at 1 mile an hour, and we were traveling faster. And we were in a very arid region in eastern Washington, where the only sources of water were springs. And so if you missed a spring, there was like 6 more miles to the next spring. So I was obsessively looking at my map and triangulating, and all of a sudden I spotted what seemed to me to be the spring and another feature, which was called Danger Point, which was this big tower of rock. And he was convinced that I was wrong. We couldn't possibly be that far. And we actually walked to this little glade with a trail running off to the side. And I said, oh, this is it. This is the spring, from descriptions I'd read. And he was convinced I was wrong. And so what happened was, I said, okay, let's stop and we'll do some reconnaissance. And so I sent my son down the trail that I thought was going to the spring. And I said that his son, my nephew, should go down the trail that he thought was the right trail. I said, okay, they'll go down for 10 minutes. They have a watch, turn around and come back to the trail junction and tell us what they saw. And then we'll make a decision based on that. So we were standing there at the trail junction, and he was so convinced that I was wrong that he completely abrogated this agreement and started hiking off the trail towards his son. And as soon as he was out of earshot, I hear this voice from my son saying, hey, Dad, the spring's here and there's a really nice tent site. And so I was right. And so he came back and he said, where's Uncle Ken? And I said, well, he went down the trail after Tim, my nephew. And so James, being something of a hero, stripped down, got a thing of water and started running down the trail to grab Ken, brought him back. And Ken was still convinced that this was the wrong place. So he hiked down to the spring, and here was this beautiful tent site. Wood was chopped, water's flowing out of a spring and everything. He said, this can't possibly be the place. And for 2 hours, he was convinced that couldn't possibly be the spring. And it took him, it was right in front of him, water gushing out of the ground, and this can't possibly be the spring. And so that's kind of the fixation, the sort of fixation that you can find. And it was probably brought on a little bit by heat, but at the same time, that's an example of that single-mindedness where you were just thinking about the speed that you were hiking and not paying attention to what was going on around you.
And those are opportunities for self-knowledge.
Yes. Yeah, I had to reflect a little bit on it, because in thinking about it, I did realize that it was a very, very hot day, and we probably weren't being as hydrated as we could be. And so I think our mental faculties were slowly getting eroded. And every time we'd stop, I would just jump right under a shade of a tree. I would start drinking a lot of water, and he would just stay out in the sun and wasn't drinking too much water. He was getting very impatient with me to boot, and I think that was a contributing factor.
Mad dogs and Englishmen?
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking to John Huth about his book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. Let's go back to the history of navigation, which is something that you write about. What do we know about the earliest navigation societies? What did they use to navigate? Where did they go with the skills they had?
Well, that's a good question, because I think one of the reasons that humans managed to inhabit almost every corner of the planet very rapidly, in fact, is because they possess an intrinsic set of navigational skills which are actually adaptive to their environment. So if we look at Pacific Islanders, they use the stars, the wind, a kind of wind compass that would help them find direction, wave patterns, but they would not use the sun, because the sun was very high in the sky and has very little directional information. And then you get into the temperate zone, where there would be some combination of wind direction, stars, sun. People would use those all together because the sun would be lower in the sky and actually gives you more of a sense of direction, where words for east and south are related to the rising sun and the sun at the midday. And then you get up way north to the North Atlantic, where the Vikings relied very heavily on the sun because the sun was low in the sky and would make a good directional indicator, but almost would never use the stars. So there's a kind of adaptability to the environment to figure out what clues work the best.
Migrating animals, whether they be birds or mammals or turtles or whatever, have some kind of inner tools. Have we lost that in our process of evolution?
Probably. One of the interesting aspects to bird migration is some birds will use star patterns. You might ask, how do we know that? So if you actually release stars within a planetarium, they'll use the star patterns to find their way. So that's known. Some birds will actually sense the Earth's magnetic field and use that as a directional indicator. There have been reports, I don't know if they're really apocryphal or not, that there is some ability for humans to sense magnetic fields, perhaps strong ones, but I can't really say for sure. But really, most of the navigation schema that we used are based on things that we would consider more rational, like looking at shadow patterns, the sun, the stars, wind patterns, things that you can articulate.
It's interesting because to go long distances, to cross an ocean, you need, if you don't have technologies and you're working with the stars and so on, I mean, that's your technology. But closer to home, there are a lot of other things. You talked being in a fog bank and looking at waves, looking at ocean currents. Some people also look at birds. I mean, that's mm-hmm. also a navigational tool.
Oh, yeah. Well, one technique in the Pacific Islands is there are certain species of birds, like frigate birds, that will fly out from an island up to 50 miles out to sea, and they'll feed during the day, and then towards dusk they'll turn and fly towards land. So you might not have a high degree of precision in being able to hold a course, but as long as you're able to get within plus or minus 50 miles of an island, you observe one of these birds and then it flies towards land, you can then follow this. And this was part of the toolkit that a lot of Pacific Islanders used.
It is amazing when you look at a map of the South Pacific and how tiny those little islands are and how much space was in between them, and not having the kind of technology that we have today, that people were running around from one island to another.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was very deliberate. I should add that there was a period where there was something of a misconception, and it's understandable because, as you say, these islands were tiny. Most of them aren't very tall, so you can't see them from a distance. And so it almost seemed impossible that humans could find their way. So there was this theory of accidental drift, that people would ride the trade winds and the currents from the east to the west, and then they just happen randomly to end up on an island, whereas the archaeological data and linguistic data and DNA information show that people sailed deliberately from the west to the east against the trade winds. So they were very deliberate in their patterns of exploration.
And learning to sail into the wind. The wind is blowing at you. You've got mm-hmm. to sail on your boat, and you just tack back and forth against the wind, and you get there.
Right, right. So there had to be some understanding, which the fluid dynamics, the aerodynamics, are actually quite complicated. You have to build a sail that will form a wing shape, and that allows you to get the right kinds of pressure to allow you to sail into the wind, not to mention the shapes of the hull that allow you to sail into the wind. So the around 1600 BC, a group called the Lapita culture, the Lapita people, started sailing from islands north of New Guinea against the trade winds and started making jumps out of sight of land of 200, 300 miles and so on. And some of them made quite huge jumps, for example, to the Marshall Islands, 0 AD, and then around 1000 AD, the Polynesians started making voyages of 2,000 miles or so.
What were some of the earliest navigational tools that people actually invented, created?
maps, for one. Maps seem to be the most ubiquitous, so we can go back to representations of maps and petroglyphs and caves that go back to 13,000 years ago. They're from cultures that we've seen, like in the Marshall Islands. There are maps that are representations of the islands, but also of wave patterns between the islands. Arab traders across the Indian Ocean and other people would actually just use human measures, like paces. The word mile, for example, which is a measure of distance, is 1,000 paces. It comes from the Latin word mille pacem. So you can measure a distance by counting your paces. Then another, just looking at the origins of words, east is associated with the direction of the rising sun. South is actually comes from the word for sun. So natural measures were the very first tools, and then people would then extrapolate these tools into things that were more precise, like astrolabes and quadrants, and tools like that, which actually were often used for astrology as opposed to navigation. And ultimately, Western celestial navigation had its origins, in a sense, in astrology.
So these things are now functionally part of history, part of academia. They're no longer perhaps so useful to most of us living in modern society with all these technological tools. What's the value, not only in studying them academically, but really learning to use them, do you think?
Well, I think there's a large part of our brain which is predisposed to taking in that information. And I think what happens is our world starts to shrink when we start to ignore these environmental clues. Getting back to the deaths of these young women, what happened to me was I experienced a kind of survivor's guilt. And I just became obsessed with trying to understand, you know, how to protect myself, I guess, in some sense, against that sort of tragedy. And so I memorize the positions of stars in the sky. I am able to figure out what time the sun's going to set by just holding up my hand and kind of measuring by the width of my hand how far the sun has to go before it sets, knowing how fast the sun moves. And I found after a year of this practice that I was much more open to my surroundings, and it was extremely fulfilling. And I actually likened it to I wouldn't say it was a spiritual awakening, but I kind of imagine that sometimes it's a little bit like that, where all of a sudden there's all these parts of your mind that is connected to the environment that you're using, that is part and parcel of our being, that we just don't shut it off because a GPS was invented. And so the absence of this awareness, I think, has kind of robbed us of parts of our mind that are there. And it would be as if all of a sudden we stopped listening to music. Imagine how impoverished our lives would be if we robbed ourselves of music or art.
Right. Or if we stopped going outdoors altogether.
Yes, for example. So I often wonder that there's almost perhaps a kind of malaise that is creeping in that is a result of automation shielding us from the world, our connections with other people. Social media replaces the face-to-face connections where you're looking at facial expressions and the tone of voice and all these nuances that are critical to how we interact. And this is how our brains are wired, and we're slowly walling ourselves off from these things.
John Huth is a professor of physics at Harvard University. He's author of the book, The Lost Art of Finding Our Way, and he will be giving a talk tonight called Navigation and the Lost Art of Wayfinding. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. For more information, you can go to sarweb.org. It's at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.